Screen Time with John Fardy. This is News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Screen Time. I'm John Fardy and this is News Talk's TV and movie show. This week on the show, I talk to the great Ben Affleck about his new Netflix movie where he stars opposite Matt Damon in The Rip. I also talk to his co-stars Kyle Chandler and Sasha Calais. I talk to the Oscar-winning composer Stephen Price about making the music for David Attenborough's Ocean, as well as Gravity and Baby Driver. Plus, we review all the week's new movies and TV shows, including the Japanese-set Brendan Fraser movie Rental Family. You can email me screentime@newstalk.com. This show is available as a podcast every Friday at 5 p.m. on the Go Loud app or wherever you get your podcasts. And it's on the radio every Saturday at 6 p.m. here on News Talk, although it's coming to you an hour later this week at 7 p.m. Good weekend to you all. I do hope you're doing well and you're surviving this cold but bright January. I'm aware that it's Blue Monday on Monday, the most depressing day of the year, supposedly. I don't know. I tell you something. If you want my advice, you know how you survive January? Stay alive as long as you can. I like January now, and I think it's just by dint of being alive for 50 years and that January's come and go. And you know, there's also no real expectation for you in January. If you park all that New Year's resolution nonsense about learning Spanish guitar and all that, you know, and you just get through it. You know, no one's really looking to meet up. There doesn't seem to be a huge amount of demands on your time in January. Just survive it. As Billy Joel sings, surviving is a noble fight. There you go. They're wry musings for a cold January evening. Anyway, I do hope you're well and I do hope you're surviving it. Now, the big news, I suppose, this week in movie land was the Golden Globes. We are in award seasons. We're going to find out the Oscar nominations late next week. And the Golden Globes happened on Sunday night. Obviously, there was huge success for Hamnet with Jessie Buckley, which we were delighted about. I was also, and she is terrific in it, and she's going to win the Oscar. I bet you whatever I could afford to bet you, she's going to win it. But I was also delighted to see, because the Golden Globes also does TV and, you know, musical and comedies and stuff, but they gave Adolescence a load of gear, including Stephen Graham and Owen Cooper, which I was also delighted about. Adolescence is a brilliant TV show that deserves all the praise it's got and continues to get. Also delighted to see Gene Smart won for Hacks. The highlight of the whole thing for me, though, was the host, Nikki Glaser, because she did it last year, I think. And I don't know that much about her, but she's hilarious, really funny. And, you know, Ricky Gervais-esque in terms of the jokes she was prepared to make about some of the people in the audience. And, you know, it's not easy to do that, to make jokes about people who are in front of you, and very risque ones at times. She has a lot of moxie. And the funniest moment, I thought, was when Sean Penn, who appeared to be about 30 yards away from her, had to sit and listen to this.
Sean Penn is also here, Colonel Lockjaw himself. Hi, Sean. You're the best. One of my favorite characters of all time. I love you, Sean. You're such an original. You know, everyone in this town is obsessed with looking younger. Meanwhile, Sean Penn is like, what if I slowly morph into a sexy leather handbag? And I feel like that's... it's hot. It's good. Sean, I love you. Not only such an amazing actor, but you're such a devoted humanitarian. I mean, I feel like a lot of actors talk the talk, but Sean Penn will actually go to the places in the world that need help the most, and he will do cocaine there. And I feel like we don't celebrate that enough. And Sean, I did get permission to tell that joke from your two best friends, Charlie Sheen and El Chapo. So they say hi. Blame it on that.
Nikki Glaser there roasting. Setting on fire Sean Penn. And in fairness to him, he took it on the chin and laughed along. I heard her talking on Howard Stern this week, and she was saying that, you know, she checked those jokes with some of his friends, but it's still a very brave thing to do. Anyway, that was Nikki Glaser roasting Sean Penn at this week's Golden Globes. I know you can watch it back on the RTE player. It was a good show, some good acceptance speeches, and George Clooney was quite funny in it along with Don Cheadle. Good show. And as, you know, Nikki Glaser said, this is the most important thing happening in the world right now. She was being ironic. That was the Globes. And as I say, we will find out about the Oscars later in the week. Do bear in mind, there will be some surprises and you know, in terms of what gets nominated and what doesn't get nominated, I'm curious to see it. There's rumors that an Irish movie in particular might get an unexpected call up, but let's see, more to follow. Now, on TV this week, I was watching this.
I can't believe Jerry's gone.
I know how fond you were of him.
I'm not going to rest until I find out what happened to him. 7 clocks on the mantelpiece. Someone arranged them like that deliberately. I think it's connected to Jerry's death.
Be careful who you speak to about this.
Stop!
Superintendent Battle.
What do you know about 7 dials?
You should leave all of this to the professionals. You're going to do exactly the opposite.
I don't know why you'd think that.
Yes, a flavour there of Agatha Christie's 7 Dials, which just landed on Netflix on Friday, I believe it was, or maybe it was Thursday. What we have here is a lavish country party ending in murder, and a witty young aristocrat who you heard there sets out to solve the mystery in this adaptation of, I think, the beloved Agatha Christie novel of the same names. The lead actress, Mia McKenna Bruce, who was brilliant in a movie from 2 years ago called How to Have Sex, plays Bundle. That's her kind of nickname or pen name of sorts. Well, it's not a pen name. She's not writing anything. Called Lady Eileen. There's a dead body of someone she really likes, who's a family friend, in this lavish country house. And it seems to have something to do with 7 clocks. I won't say any more than that. She's advised not to investigate it. And she's kind of been stonewalled by the police, but she's determined to unearth the murderer, even if it puts her in danger. Helena Bonham Carter stars as her mother. Martin Freeman plays a policeman in it. This is very entertaining. It's classic Agatha Christie. Tonally, maybe it's a bit confusing. I said that to my wife and she pretty much said, get a life, which is fair enough. I think this is good winter escapism for you. We talked about the cold January evenings. If you like Agatha Christie and the whodunit in a stately home, I think this works very well. And Mia McKenna Bruce is absolutely terrific in it. She's somewhat quirky. She's absolutely brilliant in it, and she's very funny and has some great facial expressions when people are telling her things she doesn't want to hear. She's absolutely delightful in it. So I think this is a big thumbs up. It's 3 parts, so it's literally the length of a movie, a long enough movie, about 2:45. A perfect Saturday night in for you to watch a bit of Agatha Christie, some old-fashioned English drama, and a brilliant opening scene that kind of threw me for a bit of a loop. So that's Agatha Christie's The 7 Dials, now on Netflix, 3 parts, well worth a watch. Yes, you're listening to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. We turn to the week's big new cinema release, and it's Brendan Fraser in an intriguing movie called Rental Family, all about an out-of-work actor or a struggling actor who becomes a person for hire in Japan. To find out more, delighted to be joined by Ken Doran, who's with me in studio. Ken, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
Very well. So Brendan Fraser is a struggling actor who takes a gig in Japan to play real people for lonely people.
Yeah, that's a good...
I might be wrong, tell me.
Yeah, it's a good summation, but the film kind of, I suppose, explores that a lot. So that's kind of a jumping off point, and we dig down deep into, I suppose, the nature of relationships. So, as you say, Brendan Fraser is playing an actor in this, which is kind of thematically relevant. This idea of identity, and how does identity play into the forming of relationships? So, he's kind of like an out of, or not an out of work actor, but he's small time. You know, he's job
in America or in Japan?
In Japan, so right. It's all set in Japan.
Yeah,
I think he's the only non-Japanese character in this, so it's kind of a bit of a hybrid in terms of that.
And is it in Japanese or English?
A bit of both. It's kind of bilingual, but you know, don't be put off by that. It's very...
No listener to this show is scared of subtitles, so yes. You're playing to a home team.
It's very organic the way, because he speaks a bit of Japanese and they speak a bit of English. Okay. They kind of flow in and out, so you don't even notice it, to be honest, once you get into it. But he's living in Japan. He's getting bit parts there, and as you say, he gets a job. He doesn't really know what it is. He shows up and he realizes, instead of a film production or whatever, it's a funeral. and he's basically been hired as a mourner.
Okay.
And this is the first kind of introduction to this company, and the company is called Rental Family. So they rent people out, as you say, actors, for any kind of situation. So it could be something small, like there's a character who just wants a friend to come over and, you know, have a few beers and play video games, or kind of the more complex thing. So they have an apology service, which is where, say, a husband gets caught cheating by his wife, he'll hire an actress to pretend to be his mistress so he can kind of disown her, or the mistress can apologize to the wife and, you know, kind of sort it out, and then he can continue to see the real mistress.
Okay.
So there's a lot of different kind of things, and Brendan Fraser, he's a little bit skeptical of this.
And I can imagine. And sorry to interrupt you, but this is, not that it's a true story, but this service does exist in Japan, is my understanding.
I'm not sure, actually.
That's my understanding of
okay.
it. Yeah, to a certain extent.
It's interesting because, well, what Brendan Fraser says in it is, you know, if people have these kind of issues like loneliness or marital problems, would a therapist not be better or cheaper? And they kind of say, well, there's a stigma in Japan about kind of mental health. So, you know, the very traditional views, and that's kind of a running theme as well. So I could imagine this being a real service. And I suppose that's also a theme in the film. So there's this service, and to us it sounds quite bizarre, but there's a character in it who is Brendan Fraser's friend, seems to be his only friend kind of outside of work, and it's kind of implied that she's like a sex worker. And I suppose there's a kind of a parallel there, I suppose, between that, you know, is something to us that seems quite, I don't know, normalized, the idea of a sex worker. But, you know, Brendan Fraser doesn't see the connection between using that service, but he thinks this other one is quite weird, you know, that kind of way?
Yeah, absolutely. So I presume then, you mentioned he plays a mourner in a funeral. What are the other gigs he takes on that cause the drama?
So the one, the big one that you'll have seen if you've seen the trailer, is he gets hired to play a girl's father. Because, again, with this kind of social stigma, there's a mother who has applied for this very prestigious school for her daughter, was rejected, and thinks it's because she's a single parent family. So she thinks she'll have a better chance if she gets a father in. And to kind of really sell the deal, she doesn't tell the daughter that this is the case. So she believes this man, Brendan Fraser, is her father.
Okay.
So it's, yeah, that's kind of, I suppose, where a lot of the drama and the heart of the film kind of rests in that relationship. And as I said, this is just, it's a very well-made film because it kind of picks what it's about and it really digs down into that. And I knew it was going to be good in the start. As I said, because it's kind of bilingual, it's a very visual film.
Okay.
So there's a lot of visual storytelling. So we see Brendan Fraser, he's on his way to an audition, and then, you know, he comes home, there's books about theatre, books about acting. So you're like, okay, I get this, I get what he's about. He comes home and he sits in front of his window in his apartment building, and almost kind of like a Rear Window, he's looking out across the way at all the other stories that are happening.
Okay.
So there's, you know, a family and they're sitting down to dinner with their baby, or there's a few friends and they're having a party and there's this and that. And he's watching, but not taking part.
Okay.
So this is him. You know, in the first 5 minutes, you kind of get, this is what it's about. This man who is an actor, spends his life pretending to be other people, comes home and watches other people living life, but never takes part. So I suppose that's the real crux of it, is this character's journey throughout this, you know, being employed by the service, is understanding that, you know, what makes a relationship real.
That sounds intriguing, and the visual filmmaking sounds fascinating. And I presume then the drama comes, and it's no spoiler to say it, but there has to be some dramatic linchpin. He presumably gets involved in someone's life that he's acting in, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
Or maybe not.
No, he gets involved in all of them. And I think that's part of the message of the film, is whether you begin a relationship with, you know, a certain kind of pretense, once it's established, there is a relationship there.
Even if he's being paid to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. And what are some of the other relationships he's involved in, or can you say?
I can say a notable one is there's an older actor, he's a retired actor, who it feels like a little bit, you know, forgotten about. So his daughter hires this service. So Brendan Fraser shows up as like a newspaper reporter to interview him in a series of interviews and just make him feel relevant again. But, you know, without giving it away, I suppose that relationship kind of takes on a life of its own and kind of goes a certain way. It was really poignant and really life-affirming, a very kind of funny at times, emotional at times kind of film. And in a funny way, I was thinking, I wonder, is it almost a statement of where we are in the world that a film with this concept is so positive? Because what I was thinking was, you know, this idea of people are so lonely and so stigmatized that they have to hire friends and family members. You know, if this came out 30 years ago, would it be quite dystopian? But now compared to our reality where we're asking these questions like, can an AI, you know, have a relationship with a person, that actually the idea of two people being involved, and so what if there's money? That's great compared to what we're living with.
That's very interesting that you make that kind of point about where we've gotten. Tell me this, Brendan Fraser. You know, he's not that old, but he's having a late blooming renaissance of sorts. I mean, he seems to do, maybe it's because of The Whale, but there's a melancholy to him that he does very well as kind of humor and stuff I've noticed lately. How is he in this?
He's good. That's interesting. Yeah, because you're right. I feel like when you think of his first kind of run, it's a lot of comedies, a lot of action.
The Mummy.
That's the big one. But like that, The Whale and this, there is a bit of melancholy. And is that kind of drawing on real life? Maybe is that what part of the appeal is, you know, is we kind of, you know, go into it knowing that this is part of Brendan Fraser's thing. And he's got that kind of added weight of experience, but he was really good.
So what are you going to say stars wise for Rental Family, which is in cinemas from this Friday, the 16th of January?
I would give it 4 stars.
Okay. Would Brendan Fraser be worthy of an Oscar nomination for this, do you think?
Oh.
He doesn't have to be.
No, it's a good question. The film was amazing. Was he a particularly standout? He's so good. It's almost hard to kind of say. It's like watching a master at work. Okay. He makes it look effortless.
Right.
I could definitely see an award, maybe like a Golden Globe or something.
Well, that ship has sailed, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, next year.
Next year, of course. Okay, well, that's 4 stars for Rental Family from Ken Doran, who gives it a big thumbs up. And I meant to ask you, sometimes movies in Japan, and I love Lost in Translation, but they can be a bit, you know, they cliche the Japanese as these frantic people who run around and the streets are packed and all. Is there that element to this, or?
I've never been to Japan, so I'm just kind of speculating, but I think it does a good job of balancing what is known of the culture, where we spend some time in kind of busy cities and get that element of the kind of hustle and bustle, but there's kind of quiet, more introspective moments maybe out in the countryside, and you get to see kind of the old and the new as well.
Okay, excellent. Well, that is 4 stars for Rental Family, which, as I say, is in cinemas from this Friday. Ken, thanks for dropping by.
Thank you.
Philip. What's going on?
No, nothing, just I need a moment.
Oh, what's the moment?
A moment, you know, a moment.
We need you downstairs, now.
I go, listen, I'm sorry, I can't go through with this.
Listen, all you have to do is sip sake, that's it.
Well, it's a lie. I'm messing with people's lives.
It's not a lie. It's an opportunity. The parents get the memory they want. The bride gets her freedom. If you don't go through with this, you will ruin her life. Do you understand? Get out!
A clip there from Rental Family, which is now in cinemas. And Ken Doran gave it 4 stars. I should mention that Shannon Mahina Gorman, Irish-Japanese actress, is in it. She plays the young girl who Brendan Fraser is playing the father to in one of his many roles. So I just want to mention that. The Irish are flying the flag in all sorts of ways this week. Now, up next, I'm going to be talking to Ben Affleck, the one and only Ben Affleck, about his new movie, The Rip, as well as Good Will Hunting. Now, you're welcome back to Screen Time News Talk's TV and movie show. Now, take a listen to this.
All right, what are we telling?
A lie. Get him to sign a consent to search for dope instead of money.
Man, we out here looking like a goddamn Halloween costume for cops. What the hell going on? Ain't supposed to be a madhouse.
What if they don't sign? Because it actually is a dope hole.
Well, then it's a protective search. We clear the place anyway.
Knock, knock.
How you doing this evening, miss?
Well, 5 cops magically appear at my doorstep. I've been better.
We had a Crime Stopper tip come in on this address.
A what stopper? What?
It's called a Crime Stopper tip. Right. Said that maybe there's some narcotics on the premises.
They're typically pretty reliable, so we just got to follow up with them. What's your name?
Desi.
That's your rock star name. What's your full legal name?
Desiree Lopez Molina.
Have any ID? Driver's license?
Inside.
Any animals in the house? Pets?
Just me.
You alone here?
Just me.
You mind if we come inside?
Do you have a warrant?
We have a consent to search.
What's the difference?
The difference is we don't need a judge to sign and approve a consent to search.
So I can say no?
You can say no.
And what would you say to that?
Well, you'd have to say no first.
Yes, that is a clip from The Rip, which is now on Netflix. A great new thriller starring Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, who you heard there. It's about a group of cops who get a tip that there's money in a house somewhere in Florida. They go, they think it's one amount, and it winds up being millions and millions and millions of dollars. They're stuck now because the rule is that you have to count the seizure on the scene and you can't leave, which makes them targets for a bunch of bad guys. And they have to count the money, not necessarily knowing who to trust, including one another. This is a pretty gripping thriller, a good old-fashioned thriller, yeah, quite modern, which is kind of confusing at the start in a good way, because it's all about who you can or can't trust and who may or may not be up to no good. It stars Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, as I mentioned, who are two guys on the beat. Matt Damon's recently been promoted above his good mate, Ben Affleck. Kyle Chandler also stars as one of the DA agents, Matteo Matty Nix, who's involved as well. And we also have an actress called Sasha Cayley, who plays Desi, who you heard there, who's the house they show up to, which is her grandmother's house. And it appears there's a load of something in the house. Sasha Cayley plays Desi, and she made her film debut as Supergirl in the film Flash 2 years ago. Kyle Chandler, who plays the DAA agent Matteo, is a great actor. He was in Manchester by the Sea, Bloodline, all sorts of things. And Ben Affleck plays one of those cops. And we all know who Ben Affleck is, I hope, at this stage. And I got to talk to Sasha Cayley, who plays Desi in The Rip, Kyle Chandler, who plays DA agent Matteo Matty Nix in The Rip, and the great Ben Affleck, who plays Detective Sergeant J.D. Byrne in The Rip. Have a listen to this. Hi, guys. Greetings from Dublin, Ireland. John Fardy from News Talk. How are you?
Hello there.
Hello.
Ben, you know, yes. I watch plenty of movies for this gig, and for the first 40 minutes, I really wasn't sure what was going on. I was like, who are these
people? If your performance was shite or not. But, you know, go sit, sir.
That wasn't bad, actually. But I wonder, is that kind of the appeal? You've made a lot of movies. That this is, it's hard to get your head around it, certainly at the start. And I mean that as a compliment.
It's funny, we were just having that discussion before we got on with you, talking about the ways that, you know, contemporary filmmaking, and given the ways that the culture and awareness of actors and their life and this blurred membrane around, there's no more sort of backstage behind the curtain. Mm. You know, people are often like encouraged or told they need to be performative on social media, et cetera, in order to make themselves more bankable, on and on and on. And so it becomes a very tricky thing. You've got people that you know things about, or the audience feels they know things about, and that can hurt you or help you. But one of the really interesting, I think, really compelling things about this movie is that Joe Carnahan, the director, took advantage of that and took advantage of what people kind of know about Matt and I, and also, more importantly, allowed the characters to not fall into archetypal, I think, kind of boring, predictable two-dimensionality. I mean, there's an instinct to fall back on that because we understand what the slope of that curve is supposed to look like. And so it's risk in you know, am I going to lose the empathy of the audience for my protagonist, for example, or just as important, am I going to lose the audience's antipathy for a villain?
Yeah.
This is a movie that just asks you to keep evaluating and calibrating your sense of who's who and what their agenda is, I think that's much more close to what happens in real life. And yeah. This is a movie that asks you to imagine what might you do if you were thrust into this situation, and doesn't pretend that it would be an easy choice for anyone.
Yeah, fascinating. Sasha, I was going to call you Desi, which is a good sign because that's how you inhabit the character. But when we first meet her, she's minding her own business. She's minding her grandmother's house, and hell rains down on her in every sense of the phrase. You know, that character, a bit like what I was saying to Ben, it's hard to know where she is in all this. I presume that's a great appeal as an actress, someone who's so, who is she? Is she good? Is she bad?
100%. And when I read the script, I felt that way. I didn't know who she was going to be, what she was going to do, if she was involved or not. But it's, I think it's amazing. She actually has no idea what's being put in the house at all. And she's, you know, compressed into a really interesting situation where her grandmother passes, she's been taking care of her, and she's so stressed that she's just trying to cope in any way that the universe allows her to, you know. She's like, where do I go? What do I take? What do I grab onto? And she's trying to coast under stress. And I mean, because of it, she morally finds, you know, she finds her compass, and she gets rewarded at the end, which I think is a surprise to all of us.
Kyle, sorry to keep you, but you've two articulate co-stars there. You do being one of the guys very well. And I've seen you do that before in movies, maybe in Bloodline and stuff like that. I gather you've worked as a fireman in a previous life or continue to do so in some fashion. Does that help you in roles like this where it's part of being a team initially?
Yeah, yes, it does. This, and as well as I've got a lot of friends who are working through the fire department. It's something I did for 3 years, but working through that, you end up working with the law enforcement, and then I've got a lot of friends who are either in military or out of the military now, and just that brotherhood and how that works out. And once you're allowed into that world, and you get to hear what those guys do, and it was kind of seamless. The uniform went on really easily.
Yeah. You wear it well, Ben. Can I just ask you in closing? I know certain people like me always ask you about Good Will Hunting. It's one of my favorite movies of all time. And everyone talks about the scene where Robin tells it's not your fault, which is beautiful. But the other scene in it, which I adore, is where we think you're going along with Matt's character for the movie and letting him do what he wants. But you say to him, you're too chicken, SH1T, to cash in your lottery ticket. And it's like, whoa, this guy's standing up. He's going to tell his friend what to do. Is there anything about that scene that you remember that you could tell a massive fan if you have 30 seconds?
Sure. I mean, in some ways, that scene was closest to what we really understood at that point in our lives. A lot of the rest of it, we were kind of imagining it. What might a mentor, father figure say? What might a person say at the stage of the Sean McGuire, you know, Robin Williams character's life? Whereas, you know, what we understood at that, we're 23 and 25 or whatever, or even at 19 and 21 when we started writing it, was the importance of, you know, of young men to having other strong young male, their love relationships. They're non-sexual, but they're very powerful love relationships that often, you know, just are the center of your life at that point, your loyalty to your friends. And the thing about a really good friend is that they'll tell you the truth. And the notion that I thought was really beautiful about that was it's very self-sacrificing. You know, you can't have that scene at the beginning of the movie. You have to understand this guy really loves his friend and doesn't want to lose him, but would prefer to lose him to a better life, and kind of also sees, look, you'd kind of be squandering something to fooling around here, and also saying that, not diminishing what he does or the integrity in it or the integrity in the future life. I mean, one of the lines in that scene is he says, you know, one day I'll wake up and then I'll be 50. And arriving at 50 myself, I find, A, it's a much younger age than I thought it was when I had 20, but also that it's true that one that starts to look back at one's life and the choices one's made. And those are really kind of, I'm sometimes surprised that we like had it together enough to write some of this stuff, because in some ways the words were wiser than maybe we were at the time.
Yeah, I turned 50 in the summer and I think of that line all the time. That's a lovely answer to an adored movie. And by the way, The Rip is fantastic and a great old-fashioned modern thriller. So lovely to talk to you all. Thanks a million, guys.
Thanks very much.
Yes, Ben Affleck there, reflecting on getting older and writing Good Will Hunting and also teasing my Irish accent at the start. It wasn't a bad impression, I suppose. Do I sound like that? I guess I do to an American. You also heard me talking there to Kyle Chandler, who's in The Rip, as is Sasha Calle, who plays Desi, who's the lady whose house they show up to. It's a really good watch. Good weekend, January viewing again. It's going to keep you entertained and keep you guessing. So do check out The Rip on Netflix. It's there for your viewing pleasure. And that's no lie. I often think of that line in Good Will Hunting because I'm going to wake up and I'm going to be 50 because I did wake up last July and I was 50. Anyway, Tempest Fugit and all that. That's The Rip on Netflix. Now, after the break, something very different. Stephen Price is the Oscar-winning composer behind the soundtrack to Gravity. And he's also soundtracking David Attenborough's Ocean, which is coming to the Three Arena. I'm going to be talking to him about his fascinating career after the break. Yeah, you're welcome back to Screen Time, News Talks, TV and Movie Show. Now take a listen to this. Yes, that was the thrilling music from David Attenborough's Ocean, which is going to be played by a live orchestra at a screening on the 7th of March in Three Arena. In case you don't know the movie Oceans, it is a fantastic film all about how important the ocean is. And it's not as doomy and gloomy as you might think it might be, because there's a lot of hope to be had in our oceans. But why am I playing the music? Well, it was composed by Oscar-winning composer Stephen Price, who also gave us the scores for things like Baby Driver, Last Night in Soho, and won an Oscar for Gravity. And I'm delighted to say that Stephen joins me now. Stephen, hello, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you for having me.
Stephen, I imagine, unfortunately, people like me get in front of you and you're asked very similar questions. So my apologies. I guess people are very fascinated by the idea of composing for film. But I just wonder, with something like Oceans, was it the case that you saw the movie and then decided what music you would write to it? Or are you more involved in an earlier stage?
With this one, I was really lucky in that the filmmakers approached me quite early, and I've worked with them before, so we've got quite an easy kind of open dialogue. And they turned up to my studio and basically told me about what they were doing and how they were doing it and the sort of footage they were getting. And this hope that they were going to make a film that was a really powerful piece, you know, that would show people the reality of what's going on under the ocean and show them what needs to be done if we're going to keep the oceans in good health. So it was... I was thinking about it for a long time and working really closely with the director, Toby Nowlan, who was really supportive of doing a really sort of intensive job with the music, really, and making it really emotional.
Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the word hope there, and I kind of alluded to it in the introduction. Your music follows the theme of the movie very well, because we have the beauty of the ocean, then we have some pretty startling, horrific stuff with industrialized fishing and the chaos of large commercial trawlers. And then there's, and not to give a spoiler, but I mean, it is a documentary, so I guess it's okay to do that. But there's a lot of hope in it in terms of how quickly the ocean can regenerate itself. And I was left feeling things aren't so bad here, you know? Well, I'm wondering, not to put words in your mouth, but was that the kind of arc of the musical composition for you, or is it something different entirely?
No, that was absolutely what we were looking to do. And, you know, it was, I was kind of learning as I did the job. You know, you obviously know that the ocean is this beautiful, incredible place, but the amount of connections of different kind of animals that were there and the way that affects, you know, human life was a lot of that was new to me. And really new to me was the damage that's being done by all the overfishing and the deep sea trawling and that sort of thing. But yeah, I think it was key to all of us that this wasn't just a really depressing film about how awful the human race is. You know, there is a lot of hope. And one of the great discoveries they've made is how quickly the ocean can recover if we stop doing terrible things to it. So it was important that message came across. And we did send out people with, you know, this feeling that we can actually do something about this.
Yeah. Here's one of these obvious, slightly pretentious questions, but when you're composing for either a documentary or a movie, are you a bedfellow of the action? Are you complementing the story? Or sometimes are you actually trying to be part of the story? Because there are certain soundtracks that the music, you know, is part of the story. It tells the story, and you know that better than I do. But is it a case of it depends on the project, or is it suck it and see?
I think it can be all of those things you mentioned, really. Sometimes you're really trying to tie everything you do really closely to the picture, but other times, you know, the picture doesn't want that, and you find that juxtaposing that with something totally different finds some secret way into it. I mean, with Ocean, you've got these amazing visuals, and it felt like the music really kind of could sing with those visuals. Yeah. And the way the ocean moves and the way the animals move underneath it. But there are moments where, you know, huge things are happening on screen and we go incredibly sparse and delicate because they're kind of emotional things. And whilst they're massive movements that are happening on the screen, that the effect of that is a really personal sort of thing. So yeah, there's an awful lot of suck it and see, and really just I spend my life kind of making these offerings to films, and then sometimes the film wants it and sometimes the film suggests something else, you know?
Okay, so there are many things on the cutting room floor and your job as well, I imagine, then.
That's it. Yeah, you sort of you have to keep trying, you know. You never know if the next idea might be the one that sort of unlocks the whole thing.
Mm. And I presume over the years, you know, whether you're happy with them or not, there's times you've offered things and the people making the movie have said, I'm not sure about this, you'll have to go again.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's sort of, you know, one of the scary things about it, I think, for presenting things to people. But when it goes well, it can be one of the joyous things because, you know, we all experience things differently. And you know, if I play a piece of music to someone and they come back with some feedback, which makes me think in a slightly different way, the result is often this kind of new thing that neither of us really imagined before we started, but it comes about as that collaboration. So a lot of my favorite experiences have been when, you know, people have come up with a new idea and I go, oh, and it sends me off in a way that I would never have thought of.
And last, hopefully obvious question, but in terms of like writing something, say for Ocean, is it you and a load of guys and girls, or is it you first of all alone at a piano or a guitar, or how does that work?
It is me just sort of sitting in my studio, really, and sometimes it's piano, sometimes it's guitar, sometimes it's just, you know, in the middle of the night waking up with a little fragment of a tune in my head that I have to sing really quietly into a phone so I can wake people up. And then there's an awful lot of, you know, trying these things up against the film. And I make these little demos that I can play to people. But a crucial part of the Ocean score was we wanted it to be really vocal and lots of choir and lots of human voice sort of really being the character of the thing. And for that, I was really lucky to work with a friend of mine, Lisa Hannigan.
Who's Ireland's own.
Oh, and the best voice in the world, as far as I'm concerned. And she came on board. I'd written all these demos, but we spent a glorious couple of days together just kind of trying all these different vocal approaches to it. And there's cues in this film that have got 40 or 50 Lisas kind of all overlapping and embodying the sound of the ocean. So
how did I watch the whole thing last night? How did I not recognize Lisa Hannigan? My bad.
She's there in all sorts of, she was doing all kinds of, you know, strange noises and strange vocalizations. It was incredible to hear her bring it to life, really.
Terrific. Tell me this, not to be mercantile about it, but are you honor bound to go to the Three Arena and watch all this, or is your job now done?
Well, the show certainly is done, and it's played in various places around Europe. But of all the gigs that I've got my eye on, it's I can't wait to come to Dublin. We played a show for a thing I did called Our Planet a couple of years ago, and it was the best of audiences, and we had the greatest time. So I'm very much hoping I can come along.
Tell me this, you started in music departments, so you were involved in movies like Lord of the Rings, Batman Begins, terrific movies, but you're listed as being in the music department. I wonder, when was the moment that you kind of became in charge and scored your movie yourself? Was that a big moment, and what was the movie?
Oh, it was a huge moment. It took me a long, long time. I'd been working, must have been about 13, 14 years in various different capacities in film music by that point. And gradually you kind of do a bit more here and there, and you help people out, and you do sort of the occasional music cue here and there. But you can do that for years and no one really notices. But I was really lucky that I'd helped out on a film called Scott Pilgrim versus the World. Yeah. And then the next film that the producers were making was a show called Attack the Block.
Yeah.
And that was one of those things where they'd run into a little bit of problems, and they'd run out of money, and they were looking for someone inexperienced to do the music, basically. And I was really lucky to get the call. And that was a huge break for me. So I got to finally compose in my own way.
Yeah.
You know, luckily that was a film that got noticed by a few people, and it opened a lot of doors for me.
And that was directed by Joe Cornish, a great little movie. I don't mean to be belittle it by calling it little, but I remember really enjoying that movie over 10 years ago when I saw it. I want to ask you about Gravity in a minute, but because, you know, whenever you have an Oscar winner in front of them, you have to ask them about it. But I'm just wondering, with Baby Driver, so this is going to sound like a strange thing to say, because almost like not a compliment, but unfortunately, my memory of that terrific movie is all the kind of songs in that, like the Commodores and stuff like that. And for people who don't know, the Baby Driver needs to listen to music. So you wrote the non-accidental music in that then, right?
Yeah, I mean, my job in that one was lots of hidden work, really. Mm. So I always describe it as kind of the connective tissue of the film, because whilst there's a lot of songs going on pretty much constantly, there's always these other things happening in the background. And often we'd end up taking those songs apart and rebuilding them in different ways and joining various cues with orchestra to bring out various moments in the action or the emotion or whatever it would be. So yeah, it was one of those jobs where you're hidden away, but helping to make the whole thing roll along. It was a really, really fascinating project to work on, because music was so central to the whole thing. It was good fun.
Now, I mentioned Gravity, and I do remember the music vividly in Gravity, and you were a worthy winner of that year's or the next year's Oscar. I'm always fascinated by people who win Oscars. You know, I've heard so many different stories from different people. I remember Mark Rylance saying when he won for Bridge of Spies that, you know, he thought he'd be going to parties with Jack Nicholson that night and stuff. And instead he was kind of hanging around with studio executives, and it wasn't quite what he thought it would be. What's your sense now over 10 years later, that night when they called out your name?
I mean, it's just one of the most surreal things that you know, I can imagine going through, really, because you were kind of in this world and all this stuff was happening, but you'd never really felt particularly part of it. Mm. And I remember the moment my name was called out, I was sitting next to John Williams, you know, who's the great hero of film music. And so he was the first sort of hand I shook at that point. And that would have been enough. But then, you know, you have to walk onto the stage and say a few words. And it felt so strange. I decided beforehand that if I had won, then I definitely wouldn't look down, because that's where they put all of the really, really famous people. And that would confuse me. But all that happened then was that I looked up and I could see this huge room full of people and this countdown clock, which kind of took me down. And I just was absolutely transfixed by this clock, trying desperately not to make a fool of myself. So it all passed very, very quickly in the strangest way. But yeah, it was a very happy sort of time, obviously.
I watched your acceptance speech this morning, and I was taken by the fact that you said to your parents, thanks, and sorry I made so much noise as a kid. Did you make a lot of noise as a kid?
There was a lot of music being played all the time, and I did tend to quite like the music filling whatever room I was in. So I think I can imagine from their perspective, it could get a little tiring on occasion. But they were always very understanding.
Yeah, well, that's what you need. Supportive parents, it would seem.
Absolutely.
I mentioned Baby Driver. That was directed by Edgar Wright, who you've worked with loads of times since. I presume, you know, you find a rhythm and you both get on well, and he asks you back and you ask him back.
It's just the best thing, I think, to work with people repeatedly, because you get rid of all that awkwardness that happens when you're first working with someone, and all of that kind of reticence to show them your roughest sort of work. And that just leads to new things, really. So I can play Edgar a really early idea to see, you know, how that fires him up and what ideas he might come up with. So it becomes, each time we do it, it feels like the shorthand gets a little bit better and you can come up with increasingly sort of brave ideas, really. So yeah, it's been one of the happiest kind of working relationships I've had with Edgar.
And of course, you've done a couple of things with Sir David Attenborough. I was kind of astonished watching Ocean last night. At the time of recording, he was either 98 or 99. And you know, sometimes, not to be pejorative about it, when people reach that age, you know, people say, oh, he's in great condition for what, insert age. But he really is, like, he seems to me as fast mentally and agile and sounds the same as he did 20, 30 years ago. What's your experience of where he's at now in terms of his overall ability? Because it's kind of fascinating.
I mean, absolutely that. And I think one of the things that I've loved working with him over the last few years is that, you know, as he's got older, he's used his voice in this way to really sort of bring these issues to the forefront. Mm. And you can kind of see the passion in his performances when he's talking to the camera. You know, he really means this stuff, and it's really important to him to get that message of hope across, really. And I think because of the fact we've all grown up with him, you know, when he speaks, it's definitely something we all listen to. So I'm thrilled that he's used these years to reflect back on the world changing as he's carried on, and you know, uses it in this way. It's been amazing to be part of that.
I can imagine. Well, you can hear Sir David Attenborough as part of his film Ocean, which is going to be shown on a big screen, accompanied by the wonderful soundtrack that was composed by Stephen Price, who I'm talking to now, in the Three Arena on the 7th of March. Do check it out. Stephen, finally then, you know, you have a very unusual job, more so than, you know, actors or directors. There are very few film composers. I wonder, you know, when you look back on your career, and it's still very much in motion, I don't know if there's a kid sitting at home listening to this thinking they want to do something in music. You know, I'm sure when you grew up in the UK, but your career guidance, it was probably hard to say, I want to be a film composer. They tell you to eat your lunch and move on. Like, have you any advice for the aspiring musician?
I think that the thing that I've sort of found and you know, talking to other people who work in this industry, is we all have such crazily different backgrounds and crazily different ways into the thing. Mm. What we've all shared is this sort of love of music and of working with other people, and kind of, it is possible, I think, is all I'd say to people. It feels ridiculous to be working on these, you know, things that are going around the world in cinemas sometimes, but it is possible, and so much is achieved through enthusiasm and being willing to try things. And you know, it's amazing sort of what you can do if you're kind of open to the opportunities, really. So it's it's something that you know, I hope a lot of young people get into, because I think those experiences of watching a film in the cinema with a lot of other people enjoying their time is magic, and hopefully things we can do lots more of in the future.
You're preaching to the converted. Oscar-winning composer Stephen Price, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Stephen Price there, talking to him about his long career in music composition for everything like the Oscar-winning movie Gravity and Last Night in Soho and Baby Driver, to working with David Attenborough. And you can hear his score live, played by orchestra, accompanying the movie Ocean in the Three Arena on the 7th of March. So do check it out. I know tickets are still available. That is it for this week. Thank you for listening. You can listen back to this show or any of them by going to the Go Loud player. Tell your friends about it. Subscribe to the podcast. Sell, sell, sell Screen Time. I'm only joking. Do what you want. But if you're listening to this show and you enjoy it, please continue to do so and tell your friends about it. If you want to get in touch with me about anything you've been watching, you can email me screentime@newstalk.com. I'll just have a little time to squeeze in some music from the movies. Going to leave you with some Sting. This song is used to great effect in the movie Leon. So I'll leave you with that. Wish you a happy remainder to your weekend, and talk to you all next week.
Cards as a meditation, and those he plays never suspect. He doesn't play for the money he wins. He for